I looked again, and though she was still looking at me, the suggestion was gone. What was it?
I am serious, said Estella, not so much with a frown, for her brow was smooth, as with a darkening of her face. If we are to be thrown much together, you had better believe it at once.
No,
imperiously stopping me as I opened my lips, I have not bestowed my tenderness anywhere. I have never had any such thing. In another moment, we were in the brewery so long disused, and she pointed to the high gallery where I had seen her going out on that same first day, and told me she remembered to have been up there, and to have seen me standing scared below. As my eyes followed her white hand, again the same dim suggestion that I could not possibly grasp crossed me. My involuntary start occasioned her to lay her hand upon my arm. Instantly, the ghost passed once more and was gone. What was it?
What is the matter? Asked Estella.
Are you scared again?
I should be, if I believed what you said just now, I replied to turn it off.
Then you don't? Very well. It is said at any rate. Miss Havisham will soon be expecting you at your old post, though I think that might be laid aside now, with other old belongings. Let us make one more round of the garden, and then go in. Come. You shall not shed tears for my cruelty today. You shall be my page, and give me your shoulder.
Her handsome dress had trailed upon the ground. She held it in one hand now, and with the other lightly touched my shoulder as we walked. We walked round the ruined garden twice or thrice more, and it was all in bloom for me. If the green and yellow growth of weed in the chinks of the old wall had been the most precious flowers that ever grew, it could not have been more cherished in my remembrance. There was no discrepancy of years between us to remove her far from me. We were of nearly the same age, though, of course, the age told for more in her case than in mine. But the air of inaccessibility which her beauty and her manner gave her tormented me in the midst of my delight, and at the height of the assurance I felt that our patroness had chosen us for one another.
Wretched boy!
At last we went back into the house, and there I heard with surprise that my guardian had come down to see Miss Havisham on business, and would come back to dinner. The old wintry branches of chandeliers in the room where the mouldering table was spread had been lighted while we were out, and Miss Havisham was in her chair and waiting for me. It was like pushing the chair itself back into the past when we began the old slow circuit round about the ashes of the bridal feast. But in the funeral room, with that figure of the grave fallen back in the chair, fixing its eyes upon her, Estella looked more bright and beautiful than before, and I was under stronger enchantment. The time so melted away that our early dinner hour drew close at hand, and Estella left us to prepare herself. We had stopped near the centre of the long table, and Miss Havisham, with one of her withered arms stretched out of the chair, rested that clenched hand upon the yellow cloth. As Estella looked back over her shoulder before going out of the door, Miss Havisham kissed that hand to her, with a ravenous intensity that was of its kind quite dreadful. Then Estella being gone, and we two left alone, she turned to me and said in a whisper,
"Is she beautiful, graceful, well-grown? Do you admire her?"
"Everybody must who sees her, Miss Havisham." She drew her arm round my neck and drew my head close down to hers as she sat in the chair.
"Love her. Love her. Love her. How does she use you?"
Before I could answer, if I could have answered so difficult a question at all, she repeated,
"Love her, love her, love her. If she favours you, love her. If she wounds you, love her. If she tears your heart to pieces, and as it gets older and stronger, it will tear deeper, love her, love her, love her."
Never had I seen such passionate eagerness as was joined to her utterance of these words. I could feel the muscles of the thin arm round my neck swell with the vehemence that possessed her.
"Hear me, Pip," I adopted her to be loved. I bred her and educated her to be loved. I developed her into what she is, that she might be loved. Love her.
She said the word often enough, and there could be no doubt that she meant to say it. But if the oft-repeated word had been hate instead of love, despair, revenge, dire death, it could not have sounded from her lips more like a curse.
"I'll tell you," said she, in the same hurried, passionate whisper, "what real love is. It is blind devotion, unquestioning self-humiliation, utter submission, trust and belief against yourself and against the whole world, giving up your whole heart and soul to the smiter, as I did."
When she came to that, and to a wild cry that followed that, I caught her around the waist, for she rose up in the chair, in her shroud of a dress, and struck at the air as if she would have struck herself against the wall and fallen dead. All this passed in a few seconds. As I drew her down into her chair, I was conscious of a scent that I knew, and turning, saw my guardian in the room. He always carried, I have not yet mentioned it, I think, a pocket handkerchief of rich silk and of imposing proportions, which was of great value to him in his profession. I have seen him so terrify a client or a witness by ceremoniously unfolding this pocket handkerchief, as if he were immediately going to blow his nose, and then pausing, as if he knew he should not have time to do it before such client or witness committed himself, that the self-committal has followed directly, quite as a matter of course. When I saw him in the room, he had this expressive pocket handkerchief in both hands, and was looking at us. On meeting my eye, he said plainly, by a momentary and silent pause in that attitude,
"Indeed, singular,"
and then put the handkerchief to its right use with wonderful effect. Miss Havisham had seen him as soon as I, and was, like everybody else, afraid of him. She made a strong attempt to compose herself, and stammered that he was as punctual as ever.
"As punctual as ever," he repeated, coming up to us. "How do you do, Pip? Shall I give you a ride, Miss Havisham, once round?" "And so you are here, Pip."
I told him when I had arrived, and how Miss Havisham wished me to come and see Estella, to which he replied,
"Ah, very fine, young lady."
Then he pushed Miss Havisham in her chair before him, with one of his large hands, and put the other in his trousers pocket, as if the pocket were full of secrets.
"Well, Pip, how often have you seen Miss Estella before?"
said he, when he came to a stop. "How often?"
"Ah, how many times? 10,000 times?"
"Oh, certainly not so many."
"Twice?"
"Jaggers,"
interposed Miss Havisham, much to my relief,
"leave my Pip alone, and go with him to your dinner."
He complied, and we groped our way down the dark stairs together. While we were still on our way to those detached apartments across the paved yard at the back, he asked me how often I had seen Miss Havisham eat and drink, offering me a breadth of choice, as usual, between 100 times and once. I considered and said, "Never."
"And never will, Pip,"
he retorted with a frowning smile.
"She has never allowed herself to be seen doing either since she lived this present life of hers. She wanders about in the night, and then lays hands on such food as she takes."
"Pray, sir," said I, "may I ask you a question?"
"You may," said he, "and I may decline to answer it. Put your question."
"Estella's name, is it Havisham or—" I had nothing to add.
"Or what?" said he.
"Is it Havisham?"
"It is Havisham."
This brought us to the dinner table, where she and Sarah Pocket awaited us. Mr. Jaggers presided. Estella sat opposite to him. I faced my green and yellow friend. We dined very well, and were waited on by a maid-servant whom I had never seen in all my comings and goings, but who, for anything I know, had been in that mysterious house the whole time. After dinner, a bottle of choice old port was placed before my guardian. He was evidently well acquainted with the vintage, and the two ladies left us. Anything to equal the determined reticence of Mr. Jaggers under that roof I never saw elsewhere, even in him. He kept his very looks to himself, and scarcely directed his eyes to Estella's face once during dinner. When she spoke to him, he listened, and in due course answered, but never looked at her that I could see. On the other hand, she often looked at him, with interest and curiosity, if not distrust, but his face never showed the least consciousness. Throughout dinner, he took a dry delight in making Sarah Pocket greener and yellower, by often referring in conversation with me to my expectations. But here again he showed no consciousness, and even made it appear that he extorted, and even did extort, though I don't know how, those references out of my innocent self. And when he and I were left alone together, he sat with an air upon him of general lying by in consequence of information he possessed that really was too much for me. He cross-examined his very wine when he had nothing else in hand. He held it between himself and the candle, tasted the port, rolled it in his mouth, swallowed it, looked at his glass again, smelt the port, tried it, drank it, filled again, and cross-examined the glass again, until I was as nervous as if I had known the wine to be telling him something to my disadvantage. Three or four times I feebly thought I would start conversation, but whenever he saw me going to ask him anything, he looked at me with his glass in his hand, and rolling his wine about in his mouth, as if requesting me to take notice that it was of no use, for he couldn't answer. I think Miss Pocket was conscious that the sight of me involved her in danger of being goaded to madness, and perhaps tearing off her cap, which was a very hideous one, in the nature of a muslin mop, and strewing the ground with her hair, which assuredly had never grown on her head. She did not appear when we afterwards went up to Miss Havisham's room, and we four played at whist. In the interval, Miss Havisham, in a fantastic way, had put some of the most beautiful jewels from her dressing-table into Estella's hair and about her bosom and arms, and I saw even my guardian look at her from under his thick eyebrows and raise them a little, when her loveliness was before him, with those rich flushes of glitter and colour in it. Of the manner and extent to which he took our trumps into custody, and came out with mean little cards at the end of hands, before which the glory of our kings and queens was utterly abased, I say nothing, nor of the feeling that I had respecting his looking at us personally in the light of three very obvious and poor riddles that he'd found out long ago. What I suffered from was the incompatibility between his cold presence and my feelings towards Estella. It was not that I knew I could never bear to speak to him about her, that I knew I could never bear to hear him creak his boots at her, that I knew I could never bear to see him wash his hands of her. It was that my admiration should be within a foot or two of him. It was that my feelings should be in the same place with him. That was the agonizing circumstance. We played until 9 o'clock, and then it was arranged that when Estella came to London, I should be forewarned of her coming, and should meet her at the coach. And then I took leave of her, and touched her, and left her. My guardian lay at the bore in the next room to mine. Far into the night, Miss Havisham's words, "Love her, love her, love her," sounded in my ears. I adapted them for my own repetition, and said to my pillow, "I love her, I love her, I love her," hundreds of times. Then a burst of gratitude came upon me that she should be destined for me, once the blacksmith's boy. Then I thought if she were, as I feared, by no means rapturously grateful for that destiny yet, when would she begin to be interested in me? When should I awaken the heart within her that was mute and sleeping now? Ah me, I thought those were high and great emotions, but I never thought there was anything low and small in my keeping away from Joe, because I knew she would be contemptuous of him. It was but a day gone, and Joe had brought the tears into my eyes. They had soon dried. God forgive me. Soon dried. Chapter 30. After well considering the matter while I was dressing at the Blue Boar in the morning, I resolved to tell my guardian that I doubted Orlick's being the right sort of man to fill a post of trust at Miss Havisham's.
"Why, of course he's not the right sort of man, Pip," said my guardian, comfortably satisfied beforehand on the general head. "Because the man who fills the post of trust never is the right sort of man."
It seemed quite to put him in spirits to find that this particular post was not exceptionally held by the right sort of man, and he listened in a satisfied manner while I told him what knowledge I had of Orlick.
"Very good, Pip," he observed when I had concluded. "I'll go round presently and pay our friend off."
Rather alarmed by this summary action, I was for a little delay, and even hinted that our friend himself might be difficult to deal with.
"Oh, no, he won't,"
said my guardian, making his pocket-handkerchief point with perfect confidence.
"I should like to see him argue the question with me."
As we were going back together to London by the midday coach, and as I breakfasted under such terrors of Pumblechook that I could scarcely hold my cup, this gave me an opportunity of saying that I wanted a walk, and that I would go along the London Road while Mr. Jaggers was occupied, if he would let the coachman know that I would get into my place when overtaken. I was thus enabled to fly from the Blue Boar immediately after breakfast, by then making a loop of about a couple of miles into the open country at the back of Pumblechook's premises. I got round into the High Street again, a little beyond that pitfall, and felt myself in comparative security. It was interesting to be in the quiet old town once more, and it was not disagreeable to be here and there suddenly recognized and stared at. One or two of the tradespeople even darted out of their shops and went a little way down the street before me, that they might turn as if they had forgotten something and pass me face to face, on which occasions I don't know whether they or I made the worse pretense, they of not doing it or I of not seeing it. Still, my position was a distinguished one, and I was not at all dissatisfied with it, until fate threw me in the way of that unlimited miscreant, Trabb's boy. Casting my eyes along the street at a certain point of my progress, I beheld Trabb's boy approaching, lashing himself with an empty blue bag. Deeming that a serene and unconscious contemplation of him would best beseem me, and would be most likely to quell his evil mind, I advanced with that expression of countenance, and was congratulating myself on my success, when suddenly the knees of Trabb's boy smote together, his hair uprose, his cap fell off, he trembled violently in every limb, staggered out into the road, and crying to the populace, "Hold me! I'm so frightened!" feigned to be in a paroxysm of terror and contrition, occasioned by the dignity of my appearance. As I passed him, his teeth loudly chattered in his head, and with every mark of extreme humiliation he prostrated himself in the dust. This was a hard thing to bear, but this was nothing. I had not advanced another 200 yards when, to my inexpressible terror, amazement, and indignation, I again beheld Trabb's boy approaching. He was coming round a narrow corner. His blue bag was slung over his shoulder. Honest industry beamed in his eyes. A determination to proceed to Trabb's with cheerful briskness was indicated in his gait. With a shock, he became aware of me, and was severely visited as before, but this time his motion was rotatory, and he staggered round and round me, with knees more afflicted, and with uplifted hands as if beseeching for mercy. His sufferings were hailed with the greatest joy by a knot of spectators, and I felt utterly confounded. I had not got as much further down the street as the post office when I again beheld Trabb's boy shooting around by a back way. This time he was entirely changed. He wore the blue bag in the manner of my greatcoat, and was strutting along the pavement towards me on the opposite side of the street, attended by a company of delighted young friends, to whom he from time to time exclaimed, with a wave of his hand, "Don't know ya!" Words cannot state the amount of aggravation and injury wreaked upon me by Trabb's boy, when passing abreast of me he pulled up his shirt collar, twined his side hair, stuck an arm akimbo, and smirked extravagantly by, wriggling his elbows and body, and drawling to his attendants, "Don't know ya! Don't know ya! Pon my soul, don't know ya!" The disgrace attendant on his immediately afterwards taking to crowing and pursuing me across the bridge, with crows as from an exceedingly dejected fowl who had known me when I was a blacksmith, culminated the disgrace with which I left the town, and was, so to speak, ejected by it into the open country. But unless I had taken the life of Trabb's boy on that occasion, I really do not even now see what I could have done save endure. To have struggled with him in the street, or to have exacted any lower recompense from him than his heart's best blood, would have been futile and degrading. Moreover, he was a boy whom no man could hurt, an invulnerable and dodging serpent, who, when chased into a corner, flew out again between his captor's legs, scornfully yelping. I wrote, however, to Mr. Trabb by next day's post to say that Mr. Pip must decline to deal further with one who could so far forget what he owed to the best interests of society as to employ a boy who excited loathing in every respectable mind. The coach, with Mr. Jaggers inside, came up in due time, and I took my box seat again and arrived in London safe, but not sound, for my heart was gone. As soon as I arrived, I sent a penitential codfish and a barrel of oysters to Joe, in reparation for not having gone myself, and then went on to Barnard's Inn. I found Herbert dining on cold meat, and delighted to welcome me back. Having dispatched the Avenger to the coffee-house for an addition to the dinner, I felt that I must open my breast that very evening to my friend and chum. As confidence was out of the question with the Avenger in the hall, which could merely be regarded in the light of an antechamber to the keyhole, I sent him to the play. A better proof of the severity of my bondage to that taskmaster could scarcely be afforded than the degrading shifts to which I was constantly driven to find him employment. So mean is extremity that I sometimes sent him to Hyde Park Corner to see what o'clock it was. Dinner done, and we sitting with our feet upon the fender, I said to Herbert, "My dear Herbert, I have something very particular to tell you." "My dear Handel," he returned, "I shall esteem and respect your confidence." "It concerns myself, Herbert," said I, "and one other person." Herbert crossed his feet, looked at the fire with his head on one side, and having looked at it in vain for some time, looked at me, because I didn't go on. "Herbert," said I, laying my hand upon his knee, I adore Estella." Instead of being transfixed, Herbert replied in an easy, matter-of-course way, "Well, exactly. Well?" "Well, Herbert, is that all you say, well?" "What next, I mean," said Herbert. "Of course I know that." "How do you know it?" said I. "How do I know it, Handel? Why, from you." "I never told you." "Told me? You've never told me when you've got your hair cut, but I have had senses to perceive it. You have always adored her, ever since I've known you. You brought your adoration and your portmanteau here together." "Told me? Why, you have always told me all day long. When you told me your own story, you told me plainly that you began adoring her the first time you saw her, when you were very young indeed." "Very well, then," said I, to whom this was a new and not unwelcome delight. "I've never left off adoring her. And she's come back, a most beautiful and most elegant creature. And I saw her yesterday, and if I adored her before, I now doubly adore her." "Lucky for you, then, Handel," said Herbert, "that you picked out for her and allotted to her. Without encroaching on forbidden ground, we may venture to say that there can be no doubt between ourselves of that fact. Have you any idea yet of Estella's views on the adoration question?" I shook my head gloomily. "Oh, she is thousands of miles away from me," said I. "Patience, my dear Handel. Time enough, time enough. But you have something more to say." "I am ashamed to say it," I returned, "and yet it's no worse to say it than to think it. You call me a lucky fellow. Of course I am. I was a blacksmith's boy but yesterday. I am, what shall I say I am today?" "Say a good fellow, if you want a phrase," returned Herbert, smiling and clapping his hand on the back of mine. "A good fellow with impetuosity and hesitation, boldness and diffidence, action and dreaming, curiously mixed in him." I stopped for a moment to consider whether there really was this mixture in my character. On the whole, I by no means recognized the analysis, but thought it not worth disputing. "When I ask what I am to call myself today, Herbert," I went on, "I suggest what I have in my thoughts. You say I'm lucky. I know I have done nothing to raise myself in life, and that fortune alone has raised me.
That is being very lucky. And yet, when I think of Estella...
And when don't you, you know?
Herbert threw in, with his eyes on fire, which I thought kind and sympathetic of him. Then, my dear Herbert, I cannot tell you how dependent and uncertain I feel, and how exposed to hundreds of chances. Avoiding forbidden ground, as you did just now, I may still say that on the constancy of one person, naming no person, all my expectations depend. And at the best, how indefinite and unsatisfactory, only to know so vaguely what they are. In saying this, I relieved my mind of what had always been there, more or less, though no doubt most since yesterday.
Now, Handel,
Herbert replied in his gay, hopeful way,
it seems to me that in the despondency of the tender passion, we're looking into our gift horse's mouth with a magnifying glass. Likewise, it seems to me that concentrating our attention on the examination, we altogether overlook one of the best points of the animal. Didn't you tell me that your guardian, Mr. Jaggers, told you in the beginning that you were not endowed with expectations only? And even if he had not told you so, though that is a very large if, I grant, could you believe that of all men in London, Mr. Jaggers is the man to hold his present relations towards you, unless he were sure on his ground?
I said I could not deny that this was a strong point. I said it, people often do in such cases, like a rather reluctant concession to truth and justice, as if I wanted to deny it.
I should think it was a strong point, said Herbert, and I should think you would be puzzled to imagine a stronger. As to the rest, you must bide your guardian's time, and he must bide his client's time. You'll be 21 before you know where you are, and then perhaps you'll get some further enlightenment. At all events, you'll be nearer getting it, for it must come at last.
What a hopeful disposition you have, said I, gratefully admiring his cheery ways.
I ought to have, said Herbert, for I have not much else. I must acknowledge, by the by, that the good sense of what I've just said is not my own, but my father's. The only remark I ever heard him make on your story was the final one. The thing is settled and done, or Mr. Jaggers would not be in it. And now, before I say anything more about my father or my father's son, and repay confidence with confidence, I want to make myself seriously disagreeable to you for a moment. Positively repulsive.
You won't succeed, said I.
Oh, yes, I shall, said he. 1, 2, 3, and now I'm in for it. Handel, my good fellow,
though he spoke in this light tone, he was very much in earnest. I've been thinking since we've been talking with our feet on this fender,
that Estella surely cannot be a condition of your inheritance if she was never referred to by your guardian. As I am right in so understanding what you have told me, as that he never referred to her, directly or indirectly, in any way, never even hinted, for instance, that your patron might have views as to your marriage, ultimately.
Never.
Now, Handel, I'm quite free from the flavour of sour grapes, upon my soul and honour, and not being bound to her. Can you not detach yourself from her?
I told you I should be disagreeable. I turned my head aside, for with a rush and a sweep, like the old marsh winds coming up from the sea, a feeling like that which had subdued me on the morning when I left the forge, when the mists were solemnly rising, and when I laid my hand upon the village finger-post, smote upon my heart again. There was silence between us for a little while.
Yes, but my dear Handel,
Herbert went on, as if we'd been talking instead of silent.
It's having been so strongly rooted in the breast of a boy, whom nature and circumstances made so romantic, renders it very serious. Think of her bringing up, and think of Miss Havisham. Think of what she is herself. Now I'm repulsive, and you abominate me. This may lead to miserable things.
I know it, Herbert, said I, with my head still turned away. But I can't help it.
You can't detach yourself.
No, impossible.
You can't try, Handel?
No, impossible.
Well,
said Herbert, getting up with a lively shake as if he'd been asleep, and stirring the fire,
now I'll endeavour to make myself agreeable again.
So he went round the room and shook the curtains out, put the chairs in their places, tidied the books and so forth that were lying about, looked into the hall, peeped into the letterbox, shut the door, and then came back to his chair by the fire, when he sat down, nursing his left leg in both arms. I was going to say a word or two, Handel, concerning my father and my father's son. I'm afraid it's scarcely necessary for my father's son to remark that my father's establishment is not particularly brilliant in its housekeeping.
Well, there's always plenty, Herbert, said I, to say something encouraging.
Oh, yes, and so the dustman says, I believe, with the strongest approval, and so does the marine store shop in the back street. Gravely, Handel, for the subject is grave enough. You know how it is, as well as I do. I suppose there was a time once when my father had not given matters up, but if ever there was, the time is gone. May I ask you if you ever had an opportunity of remarking, down in your part of the country, that the children of not exactly suitable marriages are always most particularly anxious to be married? This was such a singular question that I asked him in return, Is it so?
I don't know, said Herbert. That's what I want to know, because it is decidedly the case with us. My poor sister Charlotte, who was next me and died before she was 14, was a striking example. Little Jane is the same. In her desire to be matrimonially established, you might suppose her to have passed her short existence in the perpetual contemplation of domestic bliss. Little Alec in a frock has already made arrangements for his union with a suitable young person at Kew, and indeed I think we are all engaged, except the baby.
Then you are, said I.
I am, said Herbert, but it's a secret.
I assured him of keeping the secret, and begged to be favoured with further particulars. He had spoken so sensibly and feelingly of my weakness that I wanted to know something about his strength.
May I ask the name? I said.
A name of Clara, said Herbert.
Live in London?
Yes. Perhaps I ought to mention,
said Herbert, who had become curiously crestfallen and meek since we entered on the interesting theme, that she is rather below my mother's nonsensical family notions. Her father had to do with the victualling of passenger ships. I think he was a species of purser.
Oh, what is he now? Said I.
He's an invalid now, replied Herbert.
Living on the first floor,
said Herbert, which was not at all what I meant, for I had intended my question to apply to his means.
I've never seen him, for he's always kept his room overhead since I've known Clara. But I have heard him constantly. He makes tremendous rows, roars and pegs at the floor with some frightful instrument.
In looking at me, and then laughing heartily, Herbert, for the time, recovered his usual lively manner.
"Don't you expect to see him?" said I. "Oh, yes, I constantly expect to see him," returned Herbert, "because I never hear him without expecting him to come tumbling through the ceiling. But I don't know how long the rafters may hold."
When he had once more laughed heartily, he became meek again, and told me that the moment he began to realize capital, it was his intention to marry this young lady. He added, as a self-evident proposition, engendering low spirits,
But you can't marry, you know, while you're looking about you.
As we contemplated the fire, and as I thought what a difficult vision to realize this same capital sometimes was, I put my hands in my pockets. A folded piece of paper in one of them attracting my attention, I opened it, and found it to be the playbill I had received from Joe, relative to the celebrated provincial amateur of Rossian renown.
And bless my heart, I involuntarily added aloud, it's tonight.
This changed the subject in an instant, and made us hurriedly resolve to go to the play. So when I had pledged myself to comfort and abet Herbert in the affair of his heart by all practicable and impracticable means, and when Herbert had told me that his affianced already knew me by reputation and that I should be presented to her, and when we had warmly shaken hands upon our mutual confidence, we blew out our candles, made up our fire, locked our door, and issued forth in quest of Mr. Wopsle and Denmark.
Chapter 31. On our arrival in Denmark, we found the king and queen of that country elevated in two armchairs on a kitchen table, holding a court. The whole of the Danish nobility were in attendance, consisting of a noble boy in the wash-leather boots of a gigantic ancestor, a venerable peer with a dirty face who seemed to have risen from the people late in life, and the Danish chivalry with a comb in its hair and a pair of white silk legs, and presenting on the whole a feminine appearance. My gifted townsman stood gloomily apart with folded arms,
and I could have wished that his curls and forehead had been more probable. Several curious little circumstances transpired as the action proceeded. The late king of the country not only appeared to have been troubled with a cough at the time of his decease, but to have taken it with him to the tomb, and to have brought it back. The royal phantom also carried a ghostly manuscript round its truncheon, to which it had the appearance of occasionally referring, and that too with an air of anxiety and a tendency to lose the place of reference which were suggestive of a state of mortality. It was this, I conceive, which led to the shades being advised by the gallery to turn over, a recommendation which it took extremely ill. It was likewise to be noted of this majestic spirit that whereas it always appeared with an air of having been out a long time and walked an immense distance, it perceptibly came from a closely contiguous wall. This occasioned its terrors to be received derisively. The Queen of Denmark, a very buxom lady, though no doubt historically brazen, was considered by the public to have too much brass about her, her chin being attached to her diadem by a broad band of that metal, as if she had a gorgeous toothache, her waist being encircled by another, and each of her arms by another, so that she was openly mentioned as the kettle drum. The noble boy in the ancestral boots was inconsistent, representing himself, as it were in one breath, as an able seaman, a strolling actor, a gravedigger, a clergyman, and a person of the utmost importance at a court fencing match, on the authority of whose practiced eye, and nice discrimination, the finest strokes were judged. This gradually led to a want of toleration for him, and even, on his being detected in holy orders and declining to perform the funeral service, to the general indignation taking the form of nuts. Lastly, Ophelia was a prey to such slow musical madness that when in course of time she had taken off her white muslin scarf, folded it up, and buried it, a sulky man who'd been long cooling his impatient nose against an iron bar in the front row of the gallery growled,
"Now the baby's put to bed, let's have supper,"
which, to say the least of it, was out of keeping. Upon my unfortunate townsman, all these incidents accumulated with playful effect. Whenever that undecided prince had to ask a question or state a doubt, the public helped him out with it. As, for example, on the question whether 'twas nobler in the mind to suffer, some roared yes and some no, and some inclining to both opinions said, "Toss up for it!" And quite a debating society arose. When he asked what should such fellows as he do, crawling between earth and heaven, he was encouraged with loud cries of, "Hear, hear!" When he appeared with his stocking disordered, its disorder expressed, according to usage, by one very neat fold in the top, which I suppose to be always got up with a flat iron, a conversation took place in the gallery respecting the paleness of his leg, and whether it was occasioned by the turn the ghost had given him. On his taking the recorders, very like a little black flute that had just been played in the orchestra and handed out at the door, he was called upon unanimously for Rule Britannia. When he recommended the player not to saw the air thus, the sulky man said,
"And don't you do it neither, you're a good deal worse than him."
And I grieve to add that peals of laughter greeted Mr. Wopsle on every one of these occasions. But his greatest trials were in the churchyard, which had the appearance of a primeval forest with a kind of small ecclesiastical wash-house on one side and a turnpike gate on the other. Mr. Wopsle, in a comprehensive black cloak, being descried entering at the turnpike, the gravedigger was admonished in a friendly way,
"Look out, here's the undertaker a-coming, to see how you're getting on with your work."
I believe it is well known in a constitutional country that Mr. Wopsle could not possibly have returned the skull after moralizing over it without dusting his fingers on a white napkin taken from his breast. But even that innocent and indispensable action did not pass without the comment,
"Waiter!"
The arrival of the body for internment in an empty black box with the lid tumbling open was the signal for a general joy which was much enhanced by the discovery among the bearers of an individual obnoxious to identification. The joy attended Mr. Wopsle through his struggle with Laertes on the brink of the orchestra and the grave, and slackened no more until he had tumbled the king off the kitchen table and had died by inches from the ankles upward. We had made some pale efforts at the beginning to applaud Mr. Wopsle, but they were too hopeless to be persisted in. Therefore we had sat, feeling keenly for him, but laughing nevertheless from ear to ear. I laughed in spite of myself all the time. The whole thing was so droll, and yet I had a latent impression that there was something decidedly fine in Mr. Wopsle's elocution, not for old association's sake, I'm afraid, but because it was very slow, very dreary, very uphill and downhill, and very unlike any way in which any man in any natural circumstances of life or death ever expressed himself about anything. When the tragedy was over, and he had been called for and hooted, I said to Herbert, "Let us go at once, or perhaps we shall meet him." We made all the haste we could downstairs, but we were not quick enough either. Standing at the door was a Jewish man with an unnatural heavy smear of eyebrow, who caught my eyes as we advanced and said, when we came up with him, "Mr. Pippin, friend?" Identity of Mr. Pippin, friend, confessed. "Mr. Waldengarver," said the man, "will be glad to have the honour." "Waldengarver," I repeated, when Herbert murmured in my ear, "Probably Wopsle." "Oh," said I. "Yes, shall we follow you?" "A few steps, please." When we were in a side alley, he turned and asked, "How do you think he looked? I dressed him." I don't know what he had looked like, except a funeral, with the addition of a large Danish sun or star hanging round his neck by a blue ribbon, that had given him the appearance of being insured in some extraordinary fire office. But I said he looked very nice. "When he comes to the grave," said our conductor, "he showed his cloak beautiful. But judging from the wing, it looked to me that when he'd see the ghost in the Queen's apartment, he might have made more of his stockings." I modestly assented, and we all fell through a little dirty swing door into a sort of hot packing case immediately behind it. Here Mr. Wopsle was divesting himself of his Danish garments, and here there was just room for us to look at him over one another's shoulders by keeping the packing-case door or lid wide open.
"Gentlemen," said Mr. Wopsle, "I am proud to see you. I hope, Mr. Pip, you will excuse my sending round. I had the happiness to know you in former times, and the drama has ever had a claim which has ever been acknowledged on the noble and the affluent."
Meanwhile, Mr. Waldengarver, in a frightful perspiration, was trying to get himself out of his princely sables.
"Skin the stockings off, Mr. Waldengarver," said the owner of that property, "or you'll bust them. Bust them, and you'll bust 5 and 30 shillings. Shakespeare never was complimented with a finer pair. Keep quiet in your chair now, and leave them to me."
With that he went upon his knees and began to flay his victim, who on the first stocking coming off would certainly have fallen over backward with his chair, but for there being no room to fall anyhow. I had been afraid until then to say a word about the play, but then Mr. Waldengarver looked up at us complacently and said,
"Gentlemen, how did it seem to you to go in front?"
Herbert said from behind, at the same time poking me,
"Capitally."
So I said, "Capitally."
"How did you like my reading of the character, gentlemen?"
said Mr. Waldengarver, almost, if not quite, with patronage. Herbert said from behind, again poking me,
"Massive and concrete."
So I said boldly, as if I had originated it and must beg to insist upon it,
"Massive and concrete." "I am glad to have had your approbation, gentlemen," said Mr. Waldengarver with an air of dignity, in spite of his being ground against the wall at the time and holding on by the seat of the chair. "But I'll tell you one thing, Mr. Waldengarver," said the man who was on his knees, "in which you are out in your reading. Never mind, I don't care who says contrary, I tell you so. You're out in your reading of Hamlet when you get your legs in profile. The last Hamlet, as I dressed, made the same mistake in his reading at rehearsal, till I got him to put a large red wafer on each of his shins, and then at that rehearsal, which was the last, I went in front, sir, to the back of the pit, and whenever his reading brought him into profile, I called out, 'I don't see no wafers!' And at night, his reading was lovely."
Mr. Waldengarver smiled at me, as much as to say,
"A faithful dependent, I overlook his folly,"
and then said aloud,
"My view is a little too classic and thoughtful for them here, but they will improve, they will improve."
Herbert and I said together, "Oh, no doubt they would improve."
"Did you observe, gentlemen," said Mr. Waldengarver, "that there was a man in the gallery who endeavoured to cast derision on the service, I mean the representation?"
We basely replied that we rather thought we had noticed such a man. I added, he was drunk, no doubt.
Oh dear, no, sir, said Mr. Wopsle. Not drunk. His employer would see to that, sir. His employer would not allow him to be drunk.
You know his employer? Said I. Mr. Wopsle shut his eyes and opened them again, performing both ceremonies very slowly.
You must have observed, gentlemen, said he, an ignorant and a blatant ass, with a rasping throat and a countenance expressive of low malignity, who went through, I will not say sustained, the role, if I may use a French expression, of Claudius, King of Denmark. That is his employer, gentlemen. Such is the profession.
Without distinctly knowing whether I should have been more sorry for Mr. Wopsle if he had been in despair, I was so sorry for him as it was that I took the opportunity of his turning round to have his braces put on, which jostled us out of the doorway, to ask Herbert what he thought of having him home to supper. Herbert said he thought it would be kind to do so. Therefore I invited him, and he went to Barnard's with us, wrapped up to the eyes, and we did our best for him, and he sat until 2 o'clock in the morning, reviewing his success and developing his plans. I forget in detail what they were, but I have a general recollection that he was to begin with reviving the drama, and to end with crushing it, inasmuch as his decease would leave it utterly bereft and without a chance or hope. Miserably, I went to bed after all, and miserably thought of Estella, and miserably dreamed that my expectations were all cancelled, and that I had to give my hand in marriage to Herbert's Clara, or play Hamlet to Miss Havisham's ghost before 20,000 people without knowing 20 words of it.
Chapter 32
One day when I was busy with my books and Mr. Pocket, I received a note by the post, the mere outside of it, which threw me into a great flutter, for though I had never seen the handwriting in which it was addressed, I divined whose hand it was. It had no set beginning, as Dear Mr. Pip, or Dear Pip, or Dear Sir, or Dear Anything, but ran thus. I am to come to London the day after tomorrow by the midday coach. I believe it was settled you should meet me. At all events, Miss Havisham has that impression, and I write in obedience to it. She sends you her regard. Yours, Estella. If there had been a time, I should probably have ordered several suits of clothes for this occasion, but as there was not, I was fain to be content with those I had. My appetite vanished instantly, and I knew no peace or rest until the day arrived. Not that its arrival brought me either, for then I was worse than ever, and began haunting the coach office in Wood Street, Cheapside, before the coach had left the Blue Boar in our town. For all that I knew this perfectly well, I still felt as if it were not safe to let the coach office be out of my sight longer than 5 minutes at a time. And in this condition of unreason I had performed the first half-hour of a watch of 4 or 5 hours, when Wemmick ran against me.
"Hello, Mr. Pip," said he. "How do you do? I should hardly have thought this was your beat."
I explained that I was waiting to meet somebody who was coming up by coach, and I inquired after the castle and the aged.
"Both flourishing, thank'ee," said Wemmick, "and particularly the aged. He's in wonderful feather. He'll be 82 next birthday. I have a notion of firing 82 times, if the neighbourhood shouldn't complain, and that cannon of mine should prove equal to the pressure. However, this is not London talk. Where do you think I am going to?"
"To the office," said I, for he was tending in that direction.
"Next thing to it," returned Wemmick. "I am going to Newgate. We are in a banker's parcel case just at present, and I've been down the road taking a squint at the scene of action, and thereupon must have a word or two with our client."
"Did your client commit the robbery?" I asked.
"Bless your soul and body, no," answered Wemmick very dryly. "But he is accused of it. So might you or I be. Either of us might be accused of it, you know."
"Only neither of us is," I remarked.
"Yeah," said Wemmick, touching me on the breast with his forefinger. "You're a deep one, Mr. Pip. Would you like to have a look at Newgate? Have you time to spare?"
I had so much time to spare that the proposal came as a relief, notwithstanding its irreconcilability with my latent desire to keep my eye on the coach office. Muttering that I would make the inquiry whether I had time to walk with him, I went into the office and ascertained from the clerk, with the nicest precision and much to the trying of his temper, the earliest moment at which the coach could be expected, which I knew beforehand quite as well as he. I then rejoined Mr. Wemmick, and affecting to consult my watch and to be surprised by the information I had received, accepted his offer. We were at Newgate in a few minutes, and we passed through the lodge where some fetters were hanging up on the bare walls among the prison rules into the interior of the jail. At that time, jails were much neglected, and the period of exaggerated reaction consequent on all public wrongdoing, and which is always its heaviest and longest punishment, was still far off. So felons were not lodged and fed better than soldiers, to say nothing of paupers, and seldom set fire to their prisons with the excusable object of improving the flavour of their soup. It was visiting time when Wemmick took me in, and a potman was going his rounds with beer, and the prisoners, behind bars and yards, were buying beer and talking to friends. And a frowsy, ugly, disorderly, depressing scene it was. It struck me that Wemmick walked among the prisoners much as a gardener might walk among his plants. This was first put into my head by his seeing a shoot that had come up in the night and saying, "What, Captain Tom, are you there? Ah, indeed." And also, "Is that Black Bill behind the cistern? Why, I didn't look for you these 2 months. How do you find yourself?" Equally in his stopping at the bars and attending to anxious whispers, always singly, Wemmick, with his post office in an immovable state, looked at them while in conference as if he were taking particular notice of the advance they had made since last observed, towards coming out in full blow at their trial. He was highly popular, and I found that he took the familiar department of Mr. Jagger's business, though something of the state of Mr. Jagger's hung about him too, forbidding approach beyond certain limits. His personal recognition of each successive client was comprised in a nod, and in his settling his hat a little easier on his head, with both hands, and then tightening the post office, and putting his hands in his pockets. In one or two instances there was a little difficulty respecting the raising of fees, and then Mr. Wemmick, backing as far as possible from the insufficient money produced, said, "It's no use, my boy. I'm only a subordinate. I can't take it. I don't go in that way with a subordinate. If you are unable to make up your quantum, my boy, you had better address yourself to a principal. There are plenty of principals in the profession, you know. And what is not worth the while of one may be worth the while of another. That's my recommendation to you, speaking as a subordinate. Don't try on useless measures. Why should you? Now, who's next?" Thus we walked through Wemmick's greenhouse, until he turned to me and said, "Notice the man I shall shake hands with." I should have done so without the preparation, as he had shaken hands with no one yet. Almost as soon as he had spoken, a portly upright man, whom I can see now as I write, in a well-worn, olive-coloured frock-coat, with a peculiar pallor overspreading the red in his complexion, and eyes that went wandering about when he tried to fix them, came up to a corner of the bars and put his hand to his hat, which had a greasy and fatty surface like cold broth, with a half-serious and half-jocose military salute.
"Colonel, to you," said Wemmick. "How are you, Colonel?"
"All right, Mr. Wemmick."
"Everything was done that could be done, but the evidence was too strong for us, Colonel."
"Yes, it was too strong, sir, but I don't care."
"No, no," said Wemmick coolly. "You don't care." Then, turning to me, "Served His Majesty, this man, was a soldier in the line, and bought his discharge."
I said, "Indeed." And the man's eyes looked at me, then looked over my head, then looked all around me. Then he drew his hand across his lips and laughed.
"I think I shall be out of this on Monday, sir," he said to Wemmick.
"Perhaps," returned my friend. "But there's no knowing."
"I'm glad to have the chance of bidding you good-bye, Mr. Wemmick," said the man, stretching out his hand between two bars.
"Thank you," said Wemmick, shaking hands with him. "Same to you, Colonel."
"If what I had upon me when taken had been real, Mr. Wemmick," said the man,
unwilling to let his hand go.
"I should have asked the favour of your wearing another ring, in acknowledgment of your attentions."
"I'll accept the will for the deed," said Wemmick.
"By the by, you were quite a pigeon fancier."
The man looked up at the sky.
"I'm told you had a remarkable breed of tumblers. Could you commission any friend of yours to bring me a pair, if you've no further use for them?"
"It shall be done, sir."
"All right," said Wemmick. "They shall be taken care of. Good afternoon, Colonel. Goodbye."
They shook hands again, and as we walked away, Wemmick said to me,
"A coiner. A very good workman. The recorder's report is made today, and he is sure to be executed on Monday. Still, you see, as far as it goes, a pair of pigeons are portable property, all the same."
With that he looked back and nodded at this dead plant, and then cast his eyes about him in walking out of the yard, as if he were considering what other pot would go best in its place. As we came out of the prison through the lodge, I found that the great importance of my guardian was appreciated by the turnkeys, no less than by those whom they held in charge.
"Well, Mr. Wemmick,"
said the turnkey, who kept us between the two studded and spiked lodge gates, and who carefully locked one before he unlocked the other.
"What's Mr. Jaggers going to do with that waterside murder? Is he going to make it manslaughter, or what's he going to make of it?"
"Why don't you ask him?" returned Wemmick.
"Oh, yes, I dare say,"
said the turnkey.
"Now that's the way with them here, Mr. Pip,"
remarked Wemmick, turning to me with his post-office elongated.
"They don't mind what they ask of me, the subordinate, but you'll never catch them asking any questions of my principal."
"Is this young gentleman one of the prentices or article ones of your office?"
asked the turnkey with a grin at Mr. Wemmick's humour.
"There he goes again, you see," cried Wemmick. "I told you so. Ask another question of the subordinate before his first is dry. Well, supposing Mr. Pip is one of them?"
"Why then," said the turnkey, grinning again, "he knows what Mr. Jagger is."
"Yeah,"
cried Wemmick, suddenly hitting out at the turnkey in a facetious way.
"You're as dumb as one of your own keys when you have to do with my principal. You know you are. Let us out, you old fox, or I'll get him to bring an action against you for false imprisonment."
The turnkey laughed and gave us good day, and stood laughing at us over the spikes of the wicket when we descended the steps into the street.
"Mind you, Mr. Pip," said Wemmick gravely in my ear as he took my arm to be more confidential, "I don't know that Mr. Jaggers does a better thing than the way in which he keeps himself so high. He's always so high. His constant height is of a piece with his immense abilities. That colonel durst no more take leave of him than that turnkey durst ask him his intentions respecting a case. Then, between his height and them, he slips in his subordinate, don't you see? And so he has 'em, soul and body."
I was very much impressed, and not for the first time, by my guardian's subtlety. To confess the truth, I very heartily wished, and not for the first time, that I had had some other guardian of minor abilities. Mr. Wemmick and I parted at the office in Little Britain, where suppliants for Mr. Jagger's notice were lingering about as usual, and I returned to my watch in the street of the coach office, with some 3 hours on hand. I consumed the whole time in thinking how strange it was that I should be encompassed by all this taint of prison and crime, that in my childhood out on our lonely marshes on a winter evening I should have first encountered it, that it should have reappeared on two occasions, starting out like a stain that was faded but not gone, that it should in this new way pervade my fortune and advancement. While my mind was thus engaged, I thought of the beautiful young Estella, proud and refined, coming towards me, and I thought with absolute abhorrence of the contrast between the jail and her. I wished that Wemmick had not met me, or that I had not yielded to him and gone with him, so that of all the days in the year on this day, I might not have had Newgate in my breath and on my clothes. I beat the prison dust off my feet as I sauntered to and fro, and I shook it out of my dress, and I exhaled its air from my lungs. So contaminated did I feel, remembering who was coming, that the coach came quickly after all, and I was not yet free from the soiling consciousness of Mr. Wemmick's conservatory, when I saw her face at the coach window, and her